Well, good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I woke up this morning sort of beguiled by a nagging sense that today's date had a meaning to my life. And like a flash of napalm, I remembered that 44 years ago today, January 14th, 1966, I boarded a U.S. Navy ship, the USS Talladega, which we called the Tallywhacker, in Long Beach, California, for the Vietnam War. We Marines who were cargo spent much of the day loading the rest of the cargo aboard the Talladega and its sister ship, the name of which I forget. I do remember both ships had hauled Marines out into the Pacific during World War II and to the Korean War. I was able to escape a few work parties by exploring an aircraft carrier docked nearby with the Marine stationed aboard, and also by loitering around lunch trucks with other gold bricks. There were at least half a dozen of those roach coaches, who were always the first to know classified movements of Navy shipping. In late afternoon, we slipped our shore lines and steamed past a quarantined passenger liner anchored near the Los Angeles breakwater, Los Angeles Harbor breakwater, and out through Angel's Gate into the wintry Pacific Ocean, bound for Asia, like at least two earlier generations of Marines off to war. And a little bit of a postscript which I scribbled down. 3 years later, in 1969, back home, and working for a newspaper in Long Beach, I urged the Long Beach City Council to withdraw from the Vietnam War, as a small Ohio city, Beelzeville, had unsuccessfully attempted to that year. I was roundly denounced and would have been fired from the newspaper if I had not instead quit. Well, I'd like to read something today that is actually written in 1959, The Future of Machine Civilization by Harrison Brown, who was professor of geochemistry at the California Institute of Technology when he wrote The Future of Machine Civilization for the January 1959 issue of Horizon, a great rag which no longer exists. And he develops a theme from his book, The Challenge of Man's Future. Sort of a subhead to the story is, as the Earth's easily available resources are used up, our industrial order is nearing a point of no return. Barring disaster, it can prosper on little more than seawater and granite. But if it should be destroyed in a world cataclysm, it might never rise again. And as I read this, some of the terms might seem archaic from a different period, because that was half a century plus 1 year ago that this was written. But terminology aside, he might as well have written it today. Civilized man is coming to the point at which, for his own survival, he will be dependent upon the smooth functioning of his machines. Up to now in human history, this has not been true. Machines have been simply labor-saving devices, rather pleasant luxuries, which enabled us to substitute the energy of coal for the beast of burden or for human muscle. But the role of machines is undergoing a transformation, and we shall, in the not too distant future, become their slaves. We must continue feeding them. We must keep them operating. We must build new ones at an accelerating pace. If for any reason they were collectively to fail us, the kind of civilization we know would come to an end, and many of us would perish. Prophets of the future often assume that even in the event of such a catastrophe, a new industrial civilization would someday rise from the ruins. But this is probably a false comfort. The fact is that we are rapidly approaching a point where such a process of reconstruction would be difficult, if not impossible. The reason, though seldom given much consideration in discussions of humanity's future on this planet, is really quite simple. Our present machine civilization was built by making use of the mineral resources easily available on or near the Earth's surface. Within a period of time that is very short compared with the total span of human history, supplies of fossil fuels will almost certainly be exhausted. This loss will make humanity completely dependent upon water power, atomic energy, and solar energy, including that made available by burning vegetation, for driving his machines, or its machines. There are no fundamental physical laws that prevent such a transition, and it is quite possible that society will be able to make the change smoothly. But it is a transition that will happen only once during the lifetime of the human species. Once we have crossed the fateful divide, our technology will permit us to continue for as long as industrial civilization keeps functioning. But if for any reason disaster strikes and the industrial network is destroyed, easily available mineral resources, the building blocks of the Industrial Revolution, will not be there for us to use. Without them, it seems doubtful that we shall ever again be able to lift ourselves above the agrarian level of existence. Thus, humanity may well be approaching, in terms of industrial civilization, a point of no return. Machine civilization, as we know it, is a manifestation of a new stage of evolution of living matter on Earth. Since the dawn of life, the Earth has been the abode of innumerable, complex, interlocking networks of living things, each of which was molded by the combination of the environment and the biological innovations which had appeared up to that time. Humanity is the most recent successful arrival on the evolutionary scene. With the help of its machines, it has achieved an unprecedented degree of dominance in the biological environment. But like the amphibians and reptiles before Homo sapiens, its continued prosperity is not assured by nature. Humanity emerged into the world a million or so years ago, and for a large part of that time, lived much like the other animals about him. But this new creature possessed a power that was unique to the world scene, the power of conceptual thought. This capability released Homo sapiens from the bondage of being primarily dependent on instinct. Humanity could benefit from the accumulated knowledge of its ancestors. It could transmit its own store of knowledge in detail to its offspring. With the help of this power, human beings spread to all parts of the earth where they could eke out an existence. Eventually, about 10 million humans inhabited the earth, obtaining their sustenance by hunting and fishing and by gathering varieties of edible plants. That was as far as humanity could go in terms of numbers until its accumulated knowledge permitted it to obtain more food than was provided by the earth in its natural state. The undeveloped land was then saturated with humanity. About 7,000 years ago, a dramatic invention appeared that was destined greatly to enhance humanity's dominance. Humans learned that they could cultivate edible plants, and this made it possible for hundreds of humans to live on land that previously supported only one or two. It became possible for an individual to produce more food than needed for himself and his family, and thus the way was paved for the emergence of towns and civilizations. Human populations increased rapidly. By AD 1650, there were perhaps 50 times as many human beings as had existed in pre-agricultural days, about 500 million in all. Throughout the greater part of the agricultural revolution, work was done almost entirely by domesticated animals and by human beings. However, large quantities of wood were consumed for cooking, house heating, brickmaking, and metallurgical purposes. Indeed, the second dramatic breakthrough, and that's in quotes, in humankind's history, was brought about directly by the fact that the forests in many parts of the world had been cut down. In England, coal came into widespread use as a substitute for wood. But there was one important process in which wood could not be replaced. Iron manufacture depended upon charcoal, which was made from wood, and repeated attempts to produce an equivalent of charcoal from coal met with failure. Eventually, however, processes were discovered for converting coal into coke, which was a satisfactory charcoal substitute, and the iron industry was liberated from its dependence on woodlands. The linking of coal to iron was one of the most fateful achievements in humankind's history. It precipitated a series of rapid developments in the course of which a principle that we now call feedback exerted profound effect. As iron became more readily available, it came to be more widely used. The demand for coal increased rapidly, with the result that the miners had to dig ever deeper underground. Groundwater became a major problem in mining, and efforts to cope with it led to the development of a crude steam engine that could drive a water pump that operated on coal. Further development of this early engine led to its being used for other purposes. It was soon applied in the textile industry, then for transportation. These developments in turn led to increased demands for both iron and coal. The demand for machines grew, as did the demand for machines making machines. From these early beginnings, industrial civilization emerged in Western Europe. Soon it spread to North America. Later it spread eastward to Russia and westward to Japan. Today we see it spreading to China and India. Barring an intervening catastrophe, it seems inevitable that machine culture, like agriculture, is destined one day to become worldwide. In the Western world, once machine culture became deeply rooted, developments followed each other with incredible rapidity. The combination of adequate nourishment and the rapid expansion of medical research and public health techniques raised average life expectancy at birth from 50 years in 1900 to 70 years in 1950. Scientists, inventors, and engineers designed an accelerated flow of new products, devised new production techniques, and greatly increased output per man-hour. Working hours were reduced, and the flow of goods per capita continued to increase rapidly. It began to appear that the combination of science, engineering, and industry might eventually transform the world into a paradise where everyone could have enough to eat, where individuals might own practically all of the material goods they might possibly desire. However, just as the human body cannot survive on air alone, an industrial machine must be provided with energy and with raw materials if it is to survive. Our industrial civilization feeds on huge quantities of raw materials such as phosphate, rock, sulfur, water, and ores of iron, copper, and aluminum. And just as the human body requires energy in the form of food, so our industrial network requires energy in the form of fuels such as coal, natural gas, and petroleum. As per capita demand for goods continues to grow, as population increases, and as industrialization spreads to other regions of the world, the demand for raw materials will surge upward. Each decade, we must produce more materials that were produced the decade before. We must produce more fertilizers, insecticides, machines, and medicines. Correspondingly, we must consume more ores, more coal, more petroleum. But the ores that feed our machines are not renewable. They are deposited by nature over periods of millions of years and are not being replaced at any appreciable rate today. This means that as time goes by, we will be forced to process ores of steadily lowering grade, and we will be forced to dig ever deeper into the earth. This process of depletion will continue until ores, as such, no longer exist. When civilization reaches the point when there are no longer any ores, can it continue to function? We know now that it can, for if necessary, our machines could feed successfully on the leanest of earth substances, ordinary rock, seawater, air, sedimentary deposits of limestone and phosphate rock, and sunlight. We can expect that the industries of the world as a whole will pass through several stages, at the end of which time, mineral resources will cease to be important factors in world economy. As high-grade ores diminish in abundance, we will consume our energy resources more rapidly. As coal dwindles and becomes more expensive, its use will be reserved for premium functions such as reducing iron ore and producing organic chemicals. Eventually, iron will be produced entirely without coal by reduction with hydrogen in electric furnaces, and coal will be reserved entirely for production of chemicals. At such time in the future, aluminum will be produced in the main from anorthosites and clays. Consumption of magnesium will increase partly as a result of its ready availability in seawater. Sulfuric acid will be produced entirely from calcium sulfate. Increasing emphasis will be placed on the utilization of nitric and hydrochloric acid, largely as a result of the ready availability of raw materials for both. Minor elements such as copper, tin, lead, nickel, and germanium will be extracted from ores containing lower and lower concentrations of the elements, and increasing emphasis will be placed on the extraction of co-products, among which costs can be divided, and on the utilization of substitutes. The mining industries, as we know them today, will be transformed into enormous chemical industries. Eventually, the time will come when ordinary rocks, such as granite, will be looked upon as ores. 100 tons of average igneous rock contain, in addition to other useful elements, 8 tons of aluminum, 5 tons of iron, 1,200 pounds of titanium, 180 pounds of manganese, 70 pounds of chromium, 40 pounds of nickel, 30 pounds of vanadium, 20 pounds of copper, 10 pounds of tungsten, and 4 pounds of lead. Given adequate supplies of energy, these elements could be extracted from the rock, and we now know the rock itself contains the requisite amount of energy in the form of uranium and thorium. 1 ton of average granite contains about 4 grams of uranium and about 12 grains of thorium. These are admittedly tiny amounts, but the energy content of this amount of uranium and thorium is equivalent to the energy released by burning approximately 50 tons of coal. The actual processing of the rock can be accomplished at an energy expenditure considerably smaller than 50 tons of coal, with the result that it is possible to obtain a net energy profit from average rock and at the same time obtain a variety of metals that are essential to the operation of an industrial society. The basic raw materials for the industries of the future, thus, will be seawater, air, ordinary rock, sedimentary deposits of limestone, and phosphate rock, and sunlight. All the ingredients essential to a highly industrialized society are present in the combination of those substances. A great deal of water will be distilled from the sea for agricultural and industrial purposes, and most food will be grown using artificial fertilizers. Metals such as iron, aluminum, titanium, manganese, copper, tungsten, and lead will be obtained from rock, which raw material will also provide the major source of phosphorus. The waters of the oceans will provide magnesium, chlorine, bromine, iodine, and sulfur. Energy will be provided by the uranium and thorium of rocks, by the rays of the sun, and conceivably by controlled thermonuclear reactions utilizing deuterium extracted from the oceans. Liquid fuels and the whole complex of organic chemicals and plastics will be produced from the carbon of limestone, utilizing either atomic energy or controlled photosynthesis, probably both. The industries of the future will be far more complex and highly integrated than those of today. As time goes on, it is likely that the single-purpose plant will diminish in importance, eventually to disappear from the scene. Increased automation will produce far-reaching effects. Unskilled and semi-skilled labor will disappear. The highly trained engineer will become the laboring man, and that's a quote. Human supervisors will be replaced by automatic computers. The man-hour requirements per unit of production might decrease to as little as one-tenth those of the present. To many, these changes may seem fantastic, perhaps even impossible. But when we view the future in the perspective of both the present and the past, it seems clear the die has been cast. We are already well along the road, and it is too late to turn back. There is no way, except by the development of machine civilization, that the rapidly increasing population of the world can be supported. World population jumped from about 500 million persons in 1650 to about 2,700 million persons in 1958. That was 2,700 million population 52 years ago. Human numbers are still increasing rapidly, but even more significant is the fact that the rate of increase of population is climbing rapidly as well. In the absence of a major catastrophe, there does not appear to be the slightest possibility the world population will level off much below 7 billion persons. As industrialization spreads throughout the world, and if our ability to produce food is indeed the population-determining factor, the number of human beings might eventually exceed even that high figure. 10 billion persons could, if necessary, be supported but only within the framework of a culture that most of us would be reluctant to consider. As our resources diminish in abundance and in grade, as machine civilization spreads over the world, and as human numbers continue to increase, industrial society will be confronted by a variety of problems of great complexity. Perhaps the most difficult of these problems involves the perpetuation of that society. The vast network of mines, factories, and communication systems upon which we have become dependent is extremely sensitive to disruption. So interdependent are the components of the network that the sudden failure of but a relatively small section of it could result in a breakdown of the entire system. It is for this reason that machine civilization is probably far more vulnerable to disruption from nuclear attack than most persons suspect. For example, not many well-placed hydrogen bombs would be required to destroy the productive capacity of a large country such as the United States. Indeed, it is quite possible that far more persons would die in the chaotic aftermath of a nuclear war as a result of the breakdown of the industrial network than would be killed directly by the explosions. Once a machine civilization has been in operation for some time, the lives of the people within the society become dependent upon the machines. The vast interlocking industrial network provides them with food, vaccines, antibiotics, and hospitals. If such a population should suddenly be deprived of a substantial fraction of its machines and forced to revert to an agrarian society, the resultant havoc would be enormous. Indeed, it is quite possible that a society within which there has been little natural selection based upon disease resistance for several generations, a society in which the people have come to depend increasingly upon surgery for repairs during early life, and where there is little natural selection operating among women relative to the ability to bear children, such a society could easily become extinct in a relatively short time following the disruption of the machine network. Indeed, a society such as the United States is far more vulnerable to disruption than is an agrarian society such as that of India. Most of the people of India live in small villages, each an independent economic unit producing most of the necessities of life. Cloth is woven, simple tools are manufactured, and food is produced in the surrounding countryside. Were the major cities of India to be destroyed, a large number of the villages would not be seriously affected. For this reason, should a great catastrophe strike humankind, the agrarian societies that exist at the time will clearly stand the greatest chance of inheriting the earth. However, the underdeveloped areas of the world are themselves rapidly becoming vulnerable to disruption, for the reason that they are becoming increasingly dependent upon certain Western products for continued low mortality. Were a country such as Ceylon suddenly find that it could no longer obtain DDT, for example, the resultant epidemic of disease would cause a burst in death rate, which would almost certainly be disastrous. And as the new inexpensive techniques for control of disease spread still further to countries such as India and China, the vulnerabilities of these areas to disruption will in turn grow. It is quite possible that so long as high-grade resources remain available in some quantity, the West itself would recover from a major war, although recovery would be a much slower process than it was after World War II. But once industrial civilization has used up those high-grade resources and has become worldwide, it will be far more vulnerable. One thing is certain. If destroyed on a worldwide basis, civilization could never be started up again by the same steps our ancestors took. Originally, the spread of industrialization was facilitated by the fact that humanity was easily able to find vast beds of iron ore and coal, rich crystals of copper, huge deposits of petroleum, sulfur, and a variety of useful substances. But these deposits one day will be gone. It is, of course, possible that, starting from a base of knowledge accumulated by a previous society and the abilities to utilize water power and to extract magnesium from seawater, humanity might once again learn to process rock, harness solar power, and extract energy from uranium. In such an eventuality, a worldwide industrial civilization would rise once again and cover the earth. But the probabilities of a second emergence would be remote. The advantages gained by the existence of a previously accumulated knowledge would probably be offset by the scarcity of the raw materials. The situation is a little like that of a child who has been given a set of simple blocks, all the blocks of one type which exist, with which to learn to build and to make the foundation for a structure, the upper reaches of which must consist of more intricate, more difficult to handle forms, themselves quite unsuited for the base. If, when the foundation is built, the child conserved it, it could on building, he could keep on building. But if he wasted and destroyed the foundation blocks, he would have had it, as the British Royal Air Force would say. His one chance would have been squandered. His structure of the future would be a vanished dream because there would be nothing left with which to rebuild the foundation. Our present industrialization, itself the result of a combination of no longer existent circumstances, is the only foundation on which it seems possible that a future civilization capable of utilizing the vast resources of energy now hidden in rocks and seawater and unutilized in the sun can be built. If this foundation is destroyed, in all probability, the human race has had it. With the consumption of each additional barrel of oil and ton of coal, with the addition of each new mouth to be fed, with the loss of each additional foot of topsoil, the situation becomes more inflexible and difficult to resolve. If we continue to think only of the present and ignore the future, it is quite likely that we shall paint ourselves into a corner from which it will be impossible to extricate ourselves. Yet the unpleasant outcomes that are indicated by the existing trends are by no means inevitable. If we make full use of the powers of conceptual thought with which we are endowed, we should be able to avoid catastrophe. We have seen that in spite of the fact that our high-grade resources are disappearing, given adequate energy resources, we can live comfortably on low-grade resources. Further, it seems clear that humanity has available potential sources of energy which are sufficient to satisfy its needs for a very long time into the future. We have also seen that although a large fraction of the world's population is starving, there appear to be no technological barriers to the feeding of a stable world population several times the present size. We know that, although world populations are increasing rapidly, population growth can, in principle, be stopped. Indeed, it is amply clear that humanity can, if it wills it, create a world in which human beings can live comfortably and in peace with each other. If we fail this challenge, there is every likelihood that our civilization will perish, never to reappear. And that was by Harrison Brown, The Future of Machine Civilization. And when he wrote this in 1959, for the January 1959 issue of Horizon, he was professor of geochemistry at the California Institute of Technology. And this is a theme from a book he wrote, The Challenge of Man's Future. Now, there are certain possibilities that he didn't mention at the time, such as exploiting the regions nearby in our neighborhood solar system, those little rocks or asteroids that are spinning around by the hundreds of billions, that perhaps we can extract ores and everything else, maybe even squeeze some water from the moon, as has just been made possible lately by a certain research spaceship sent to it. Yet, he brings up exactly the problems we face now. We've already damn near reached that 7 billion mark, if we haven't already. Well, this has been Michael McCusker. Perhaps I'll see you next week if the sky doesn't fall, or a train, or a plane, or a ship, or a car doesn't collide with my frail frame.